Hello and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types from a left-wing perspective. This is Travis. I am solo this morning, so I'm going to be doing this K-Gro X style first thing in the morning. Haven't had my coffee, a little loopy. Difference is I don't have like 27 kids that I had to get off to school or basketball practice, Boy Scouts, Junior Marines and space camp and all the things he manages to do. Good grammar there, Travis. All the things he manages to do before he's even had coffee. I just had to walk a couple dogs. Rachel will not be joining us this morning. She is attending to some family issues, which is why we didn't podcast last night like we usually do. She is fine. She just has some things to attend to. She will be back next episode, of course. We had a really great episode planned where a friend of mine who is a lawyer who's been working up at Standing Rock in North Dakota is defending people that are being charged for demonstrating, basically. And we are going to have her on again. We are going to have her for the first time at some point coming up soon. Unfortunately, it didn't work out last night, but that would have been cool. Now you're just stuck with me here recapping a lot of crap that has been going on over the past week. And I guess I will start with the Trump tweets this morning. Another technical note, it has come to my attention that the interface that I use for certain shows, when we podcast here at my apartment in downtown Denver, has become a little dodgy, hence some of the background noise that I've tried to filter out and fix. That hasn't been terribly effective. I do have a new interface. I haven't figured out quite how to use it yet, so that is why still broadcasting on the old one. And apologize for that. We will fix that as soon as humanly possible. Anyway, so it was either last night or this morning that Representative John Lewis, you should know who he is, of course. If that you don't know who that is for some reason, apparently Donald Trump may not, then you should Google him immediately. Anyway, he's been one of the more ballsy Democratic members of Congress who's kind of taken this Trump-Russia bull by the horns here and said, hey, this is actually a real huge problem, and it undermines the office, it undermines the president-elect, and it actually questions his legitimacy, which are all valid things to say, are all valid points, but not that many Democrats have wanted to come out and be that forceful about it. John Lewis is one of them, because John Lewis gives no F's. Why should he? He was literally beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Alabama fighting for civil rights. He is not going to stifle himself for the sake of keeping up appearances. When he has an opinion, he is going to let his opinion be known, and we love him for it. And he's great for it, and our country is a better place for it. That is not the way Donald Trump sees it, obviously. And I'm going to try to get the exact quotes for you, so you know I'm not grossly paraphrasing everything here. But essentially, John Lewis, in light of the things that have come to light with the ties of Trump to Russia and Putin, which we knew about before the election, but now the media seems to actually care about reporting on. The FBI still doesn't, of course, which is another topic that we're going to get to. But essentially, John Lewis said, I will try to work with this president, but I don't really consider him legitimate, I think was close to the wording he used. And Trump being Trump, reacted by attacking John Lewis, of course, but in the worst way possible, saying the worst things possible. No, he didn't shout the N-word. That's for his supporters, the Pepe the Frogs out there. But he said, and I'm going to pull up the tweets here. First, let's roll back to a hypothetical world where Trump was something of a statesman, or at least knew how to play the part, where, you know, he couldn't help himself but react to these things, but he reacted like someone who doesn't want to step on political landmines, or knew better, or had any control over his emotions. Let's say John Lewis said these things and Trump was seriously irritated by it and felt he needed to respond for some reason. One, you could frame it this way. You could say, I respect John Lewis and his service tremendously. He's a great civil rights icon. And on this weekend, Martin Luther King Day coming up, I respect him tremendously, but I felt his comments saying my presidency is illegitimate was out of line, and I think he should apologize. Wouldn't have agreed with him on the last bit, of course, but I actually would not have had a problem with that statement overall. It's saying what needs to be said. It's paying due respect, and it's saying, you know, that kind of hurt my feelings. And I would have been fine with that. And of course, no, I don't think in any universe, even if Trump had been very polite and statesmanly about it, that John Lewis owes Trump an apology for anything. But had that comment been made in that context, I don't think anybody would have had a problem with it, really. Maybe a little bit, but not a huge one. But that's, of course, not what Trump said. Trump took to Twitter, which is going to be his main form of communication with the country in this postmodern era, dawn of idiocracy. And, okay, yeah, so John Lewis's quote was, I don't see this president-elect as a legitimate president, he said on Meet the Press. Now, that was in the context of talking about the Russians, and he said, I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. Well, we know this isn't hypothetical anymore. The reports that have come out from the intelligence agencies have basically confirmed this, and you even have some Republicans in Congress admitting it. I mean, there's no way to hide it anymore. It is what it is. So Trump comes back, and I'm looking for the exact tweets right now so that I don't get it wrong. Okay. He said he should spend more time on fixing and helping his district, which is in horrible shape and falling apart, parentheses, not to mention crime infested, rather than falsely complaining about the election results. All talk, 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 no action or results. Sad! Exclamation point. Okay, look, if you're going to call John Lewis, if you're going to make a criticism about John Lewis, and I'm going to get to criticism about John Lewis because this is not the first time that this podcast has had to come out and chastise people for attacking John Lewis. Only the people we were attacking before were Bernie Sanders supporters, because he was a Hillary Clinton supporter, John Lewis was, from fairly early on in the process, and they just hated that, and they called him a sellout and all kinds of other horrible things, and said things similar to kind of maybe what Trump is saying right now, to which we have absolutely no time for those people, and we don't want to breathe the same air as them, especially if they call themselves progressives. So Trump, I guess, has something in common with them, which is kind of a recurring theme that Rachel and I examine here over and over, that of the crossover of the hardcore Bernie supporters and some of the Trump ideology here. And if you have a problem with that, maybe just deal with reality and don't yell at me on Twitter, and certainly not John Lewis. But that's sort of another topic that's secondary to what we're talking about right now. And look, if you're going to make a criticism of John Lewis, and I explained one way that you could have done it that was actually sounded like a human being, which of course Trump did not, you don't call John Lewis all talk, no action or results. This is a guy that got his head beaten in by, you know, in Alabama, fighting and marching for civil rights that eventually led to the civil rights movement. Now, of course, many of Trump's hardest, most ardent supporters will eat that up, and they don't like the civil rights movement. They want to roll back things pre-1964, but I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about how will America and the world at large see it. And so far, they're reacting fairly scathingly. But I have a caveat to that. Because we saw this before. When Donald Trump attacked Kaiser Khan and the Khan family after they criticized Trump, it blew up all over the world in the internet, and everybody thought Trump was finished, and he looked like an insane person, like a loose cannon with no tact whatsoever, with no respect for a Gold Star family. And even many, many Republicans came out and said, he's crossed the line here, he should take it back, which they're doing now. Some of them are doing now with these John Lewis comments this morning. Even the Russians at that point supposedly were ready to end their Help Trump Win campaign project because they figured that the Republicans would replace him on the ticket because he was a crazy person and had no chance of winning. They were wrong. They underestimated the American voting population and the Republican Party. And I think they're probably doing the same thing here, I have to say. I'm obviously horrified. Millions of Americans are obviously horrified. The 60-something percent that find Trump unfavorable before he's even taking office, I'm sure, find it horrifying and unacceptable. And then my question ultimately is, so what? Did the Khan fiasco cost Trump anything besides few weeks of really, really, really bad press? And what did those few weeks of really, really, really bad press amount to? A sliding in the polls that turned out to be completely inaccurate anyway, and made us, you know, go back and re-question the whole art of polling. Like, what is this going to cost Trump? That he comes out and attacks John Lewis and sounds like a wild, crazy lunatic who can't even look at a calendar and realize how politically devastating it is to do something like that to someone like John Lewis at this time before he's entered office. And he's, you know, he's already had this horrible, horrible weeks of press with everything that's coming out about his ties to Russia and his refusal to remove himself from his business interests, which was obvious was going to happen, and everything else. For him to do that seems crazy and politically suicidal, but nothing has cost this guy. So why will this? And I don't think it will, besides a few weeks of bad press. And somebody within the Trump campaign might clean this up and send out a tweet from an Apple device, meaning not Trump's, and say, John Lewis is an American hero and a civil rights icon, and I meant no disrespect, but I disagree with his comments and feel he was out of line. And they might finally, eventually, not in Trump's words, somebody from the campaign might release some kind of statement to that end later today or tomorrow, but they might not. And you can't unring the bell, and the damage is already done, and it doesn't matter. But that's the big takeaway going the other way as well. It doesn't matter. I mean, what's going to happen? What's going to change the trajectory of this incoming president? Nothing matters. And this goes to a deeper point. I've been reading tweet after tweet after tweet. If it's the Pissgate stuff, if it's some of the ties where his incoming staff is talking to the Kremlin, possibly in violation of the Hatch Act or other things. And I keep seeing these otherwise smart political people saying, oh, this is going to unravel the Trump presidency. This is a huge problem. This completely delegitimizes, you know, this is a cataclysmic problem. This is going to prompt a constitutional crisis. And I'm thinking, how? Why? you know, we're still the people that report on politics and the people that opine on politics and the people who look at what happens in Washington, D.C. and form opinions are still in this pre-Trump world where things made sense, where things were logical and rational and could be explained. And that sort of eroded the moment Trump actually won the candidacy and became the GOP nominee for president. And then it completely fell apart on election night. And I don't blame people for still living in the world that still makes sense, because when you've been reporting on it for years and writing about it, that's what you know. And it takes time to adjust to a new post-fact, post-sense reality in this country that really doesn't make sense, where nothing really matters that ever mattered before, and no one really cares. I mean, I don't want to say no one, but not enough people to prevent a fascist, orange-faced Russian puppet to take office. But that's where we are. So they keep, they keep reporting on this stuff as if anything made sense and anything mattered. And we lived in a world where a Donald Trump could not become president of the United States, which is, of course, antithetical to reality, because Donald Trump is now going to be sworn in as president of the United States. So they're still working within that paradigm and still making these opinions that all these horrible things that we knew about Donald Trump long before election night now somehow matter, in a sense that enough of the American public is going to turn on him, or the Supreme Court or the Republican Congress. And you do have Obama's Department of Justice and FBI, and I call it Obama's even though Comey's at the helm, because once Trump gets in there, he's going to put a bunch of sycophants in every intelligence agency and every watchdog agency and the Department of Justice and the Supreme Court and everywhere else. And then things really aren't going to matter. But, you know, what can they do in 9 days, and what would they do that Congress would go along with? And the answer is not much. So when I say none of this matters, I mean none of it matters. It is worth talking about because it is crazy and it is unprecedented, and it is further highlighting of how unbelievably unfit this person is to hold any sort of public office, let alone the most powerful in this country in the world. Yet it's happening, but people are still writing and penning opinions as if something is going to happen to prevent this catastrophe from actually coming to fruition when he takes the oath of office. And my answer is, you're out of touch with reality. The new reality does not, there is no roadmap to sanity here in this country and in governance of this country. Like, there's still this belief that the Republican Congress is going to stand up and prevent the worst of this from occurring somehow. No. That once Donald Trump appoints whatever fool gets rubber stamped by the Senate to become the Ninth Justice, and eventually Ginsburg will have to retire and Kennedy will retire, and you know, these very, very old members of the Supreme Court who lean left are going to retire, and God knows what we're going to get in there. They're all going to get rubber stamped by this GOP Senate. Like, they're going to stand up to Trump? The Congress is that's one thing I don't know if irks is the right word, but I keep seeing that Trump's actions, particularly with Russia and particularly with refusing to divest himself from his business interests, are going to provoke what they keep calling a constitutional crisis. And I keep thinking, do they imagine that the Constitution is this living, and I don't talk, when I talk about a living document, I mean like they think it's a living entity that's going to rise up and do something on its own accords. The Constitution, a constitutional crisis happens when the Constitution needs to be defended against one of the branches of government overstepping itself. And of course, the GOP Congress thinks it's been doing this against Obama for years. But now they say this is a constitutional crisis, as if one of the branches of government, that being the judicial branch or the legislative branch, is going to rise up and defend the document if it's being trampled upon by a Donald Trump. And I'm thinking, by whom? By the Republican-controlled Congress? No. No. There are things that the Democrats in Congress can do, but they're very, very limited. By the Supreme Court, which will soon be 5-4, not in our favor. When I say not in our favor, I mean in favor of common sense and justice and reasonableness and rationality and everything else. And certainly nobody within the executive branch after 9 days. So how is it going to be a constitutional crisis when there's literally nobody that's going to stand up and defend the Constitution? The Constitution can't defend itself. It's a piece of paper. It's words on parchment. The Constitution becomes this entity wherein a crisis can be provoked when at least one of the branches in government steps up to offend it when its sanctity is being threatened, as it is and will be by the Donald Trump administration. And there's simply no there in terms of defending it. So no, there's not going to be a constitutional crisis because nobody's going to step up and defend the Constitution. I mean, okay, that's a bit hyperbolic, but no branch of the government in unity and solidarity and effectiveness to thwart Donald Trump's power is going to step up to defend it. It's just not going to happen. And I would love to be wrong about this, but please tell me how I'm wrong. And you know, I'm a nobody on Twitter. This podcast has 300 followers, and I think half of them are like self-help gurus or some crap. So, you know, what do these people care, these journalists? I mean, some journalists and reporters do respond to me on Twitter, but when I point this out, I don't expect them to respond because A, there's no answer to it, and B, I'm nobody. But where's the constitutional crisis? All these scandals, these missteps, insulting John Lewis, these devastating ties to Russia, who is going to step in and force Donald Trump to separate himself from Russia, separate himself from his business interests, appoint people to his cabinet who are not also puppets of Putin and Russia? Who? How? Where? I don't see how it's possible, and I don't see how it happens. So the simple answer is, it's not going to happen. There is not going to be great defenders riding in to defend the Constitution. Donald Trump is going to shred it. And we are going to have to take it to at least 2018 or 2020. And that is the reality of the situation. Now, there's ways to mitigate it and create a resistance. And we're trying to do that piece by piece. But it is a much more difficult process. Of course, the best thing would have been to not elect this guy in the first place. But so here we are. Okay, so I just spilled my tea all over the console here. Had to pause it and run and get a bunch of paper towels. Beginning of this episode of Irreverent Testimony is starting splendidly. So thanks for sticking around. Anyway, though, I wanted to switch gears to Trump and Russia real quick. There was a very interesting entry in Juan Cole's blog, who I've been following for several years, and it's entitled "For Russian Hold on Trump, Follow the Money, Not the Sex Tapes." Of course, I don't know if that's directed to us at the media. We know the media is going to follow the sex tapes, if nothing else, because that makes for juicier headlines. And that's probably what Trump is way more concerned with than his financial ties. But let's go. I'm going to go ahead and just read this because it's really interesting and it raises a lot of interesting discussion points. So Juan Cole says, he published this a couple days ago, BuzzFeed has published the unverified allegations by a former MI6 analyst with good Russian contacts. MI6, of course, is the British intelligence agency. contained in a 2-page hitherto secret annex to the U.S. intelligence community's report on Russian hacking and interference in the 2016 election. These 2 pages have circulated in Washington for months. David Korn of Mother Jones talked about them, though not with salacious detail, in October, which was ignored. And then Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid wrote a sharp letter to FBI Director James Comey about them. And of Comey, of course, sat on that, but not so much new document of supposedly a new or reopened investigation into the Clinton emails, thanks to Anthony Weiner's borrowing of Huma Abedin's laptop, which turned out to be an absolute huge nothing burger, which a lot of people think actually turned the tide of the election and made Trump president. Whee! Anyway. Okay, so back to the article. The notion that Donald J. Trump might have been recorded doing kinky things on business trips to Moscow or St. Petersburg is plausible, but people should be careful here. It isn't proven, and intelligence professionals gather a lot of raw intelligence that is nonsense. The specific allegations in the annex don't make much sense. Urolagnia is a fetish for sexual satisfaction, not an instrument of revenge on a political opponent. With the Russians, I don't know. Anyway, that's Juan Cole's opinion. Note, too, that this is just as plausible that the National Security Agency and or the CIA have data on Trump and Russia. If Trump were in contact with Russians whom the NSA was monitoring, they would have ended up monitoring him as well. That is a really good point that Juan Cole makes. That is, if the worry is that foreign intelligence agencies could blackmail someone like Trump, why isn't it equally worrying that the U.S. government could? J. Edgar Hoover used to blackmail congressional representatives all the time. That's very, very true. And that is sort of an angle I haven't really thought of, because between Comey and Giuliani's meddling with the New York FBI, I've kind of thought that the intelligence agencies have been in bed to help Trump for the most part, or at least large factions of them. But you actually don't want your intelligence agencies to be able to blackmail people in the executive branch or legislative branch either, for a lot of important reasons. And that is a good point that I hadn't thought of. Moving on. The unusual thing here is that even if Russia had such video, it is difficult to see how they could damage Trump. The people who elected him knew that he had appeared in pornographic videos, liked to tour dressing rooms of Miss Teen contests when the contestants were naked, and gropes random women in public places. All good points. That he paid for a golden shower or two isn't even the most disgusting thing in his closet, at least if it was paid for, it was consensual. So I think if Russia threatened him with being outed, he could just brush them off. The evangelical ministers who encourage their flocks to vote Republican have decided that they are all about forgiveness when it comes to Trump, I would say, and other Republicans at large. I wouldn't have said this last year this time, but the guy is Teflon on the right. That's exactly what I've been screaming about the last 20 minutes. So thank you, Juan Cole. Moving on. If Trump has a vulnerability with regard to Russia, it is far more likely to be financial. He kept going bankrupt 6 times as a strategy to avoid paying creditors, and understandably, real banks stopped wanting to lend to him. The Financial Times alleges that Trump then got in bed with very wealthy figures, I don't know if literally, but from Kazakhstan, who loaned him money or licensed his name. A Borat connection. E.g., the Trump Soho, in which he was a partner with a shadowy Kazakh figure. But FT suggests that the quid pro quo was what he got them into the New York real estate market, which they then used for money laundering. Money earned from embezzling, say from the Kazakh Ministry of Petroleum, or criminal activity needs to be laundered before it can be openly invested. Yep, that's how money laundering works. The criminal claims that the ill-gotten funds are profits from an investment, e.g. the FT, thinks Trump may have knowingly or naively facilitated this kind of activity. If it was knowingly, of course, that was a heavy duty crime. And again, then my next question is, to be prosecuted by whom? Anyway. Or there is the Washington Post expose of Trump's relationship with a Russian, quote, businessman, whom the Post characterizes as possibly having links to organized crime, and whom the Post alleges former business partners accuse of routinely threatening to kill them. Oh, put him on the cabinet. In fact, big business people often seal deals at strip clubs and sex parties in St. Petersburg were likely to be sweeteners for a business deal. That probably happens in Washington, D.C., too, to be honest. Anyway, only Puritan Americans would think it was the sex party that was the important thing. Well, welcome to America, Mr. Cole. James S. Henry in the American Interest surveyed several cases of Trump's sketchy financial relationships with Russian or former Soviet Union oligarchs. Henry doesn't allege criminality in these relationships, though the accounts he gives heavily hint at it. And if there ever was a place where Honoré de Balzac's maxim in Le Père Goriot was true, and I'm sorry if I mangled the French pronunciation of all that, it is post-Soviet lands. Balzac said, "The secret of great fortunes with no apparent explanation is a crime forgotten because it was well executed." Mario Puzo paraphrased it to, "Behind every great fortune, there is a crime." And Mario Puzo obviously penned the Godfather saga. Mark Sumner at Daily Kos also rounds up these oligarch organized crime links. "So if Russia has a hold on Trump, I'd look at the business angle myself. The idea that they could shame him by attacking his reputation for sexual propriety seems a little far-fetched." I don't think it is, because I think it's personally embarrassing for Trump. I think that's what Juan Cole kind of misses here. And I actually think Trump would be – I think Trump probably skates more on the shady financial – Trump's been getting away with shady financial crap for literally his entire career. So – While I get what Juan Cole's saying, I don't necessarily agree with the premise. And I actually think that Trump would be more likely to feel personally damaged by tapes, especially if he's into like a humiliation, which, you know, Rachel and I have been speculating about for months, way, way before that we thought Trump was ever going to be the GOP nominee, let alone the president. My speculation, she thought he was like a pseudo dom, and my speculation was no, this guy likes to get tied up, peed on, slapped, maybe wear diapers, act like a baby. I think that's where he gets off, and it turns out that I may have been spot on. So go me, I guess. I get a prize. Anyway, I want to go to Mark Sumner's article now about the organized crime links, because I think that one was really interesting too. Mark Sumner, of course, a writer over at Daily Kos, where I have occasionally written for in the past. Anyway, let's go to his article real quick, which is entitled "Donald Trump Was Bailed Out of Bankruptcy by Russia Crime Bosses." And probably will continue to be. In 2008, Donald Trump Jr., kind of the brains behind this operation, if you believe that, attended a real estate conference where he stated that, quote, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia." So that's not me or us evil liberal saying it. That's Donnie Jr. Anyway, so Mark Sumner goes on to write, "As it turns out, that may have been an understatement. Human rights lawyer Scott Horton, whose work in the region goes back to defending Andrei Sakharov and other Soviet dissidents," I'm sorry if I got that name wrong, "has gone through a series of studies by the Financial Times to show how funds from Russian crime lords bailed Trump out after yet another bankruptcy. The conclusions are stark." Quoting from that story, "Among the powerful facts that DNI missed were a series of very deep studies published in the Financial Times that examined the structure and history of several major Trump real estate projects from the last decade, the period after his seventh bankruptcy and the cancellation of all his bank lines of credit." Remember, this is the guy that was the successful businessman, and that's why he's going to make a great president. "The money to build these projects flowed almost entirely from Russian sources." I wonder why he's so in love with Russia. They're propping him up. "In other words, after his business crashed, Trump was floated and made to appear to operate a successful business enterprise through the infusion of hundreds in millions of cash from dark Russian sources. He was their man." So the Russian mafia and Putin are kind of running the country now, guys. Yay, America, mom, apple pie. "Yes, even that much seems fantastic," Sumner writes. "And the details include business agencies acting as a front for the GRU, billionaire mobsters, a vast network of propaganda sources like CNN, and an American candidate completely under the thumb of the Kremlin." proud to be an American where at least I know how. It reads like a B-grade spy novel, a plot both too convoluted and too bluntly obvious for John le Carré. The problem is that it may not be a conspiracy theory. It may be a conspiracy. Horton's analysis comes from piecing together information in the three Financial Times, quote, deep reports. One of these focused on Sergey Milian, the head of the Russian-American Chamber of Commerce in the U.S. at the time of Trump Jr.'s money pouring in from Russia claim. Mr. Milian insists his Russian-American Chamber of Commerce, and this is from the Financial Times again, RACC, has nothing to do with the Russian government. He says it is funded by payments from his commercial members alone. Most of the board members are obscure entities, and nearly half of their telephone numbers went unanswered when called by the Financial Times. I probably don't answer the phone if they don't recognize the number, but then so do I. Most of the board members are obscure entities, and nearly half of their telephone numbers went unanswered. I already read that. An FT reporter, that's Financial Times, found no trace of the Chamber of Commerce at the Wall Street address listed on his website. Well, we know that trick. I'm from Miami. There's all kinds of fronts where nobody lives for all kinds of interesting businesses. So, why was the RACC's background filled with so many holes? The Financial Times quotes former Russian MP Konstantin Borovy in tagging the chamber as a front for intelligence operations that dates back to Soviet times. The Chamber of Commerce institution are the visible part of the agent network. Russia has spent huge amounts of money on this. Milian helped arrange for Trump to visit Moscow in 2007 for a P tour, I guess, and had other outings with Trump in the States, including a visit to horse races in Miami. There's always a Miami connection, guys. Always. If there's something shady or conspiratorial or that, you know, is going to end the world or assassinate a president or something, always a Miami tie. Always. Okay, where was I? Milian claims that he had the right to market Trump properties in Russia. You could say I was their exclusive broker, he told RIA. Then in 2007-2008, dozens of Russians bought apartments in Trump properties in the U.S. He later told ABC television that the Trump organization had received hundreds of millions of dollars through deals with Russian businessmen. So it's not like this stuff is so covert that it doesn't never gets talked about. I mean, Trump Jr. talks about it in front of big crowds. People go on ABC. It's like they're kind of flaunting it and sticking it in everybody's face while the Trump supporters say, no, there's no Russian connection, you liberals. Mike Huckabee comes out and makes jokes about it, about the darn Russians. And, you know, it's like they're not even really trying to hide it. Despite documents and photos showing Trump with Milian, Trump denied their association during the campaign. Of course. Of course. Hope Hicks, how does she do it by herself? Mr. Trump's campaign spokeswoman said Mr. Trump had, quote, met and spoke with Mr. Milian only, quote, on one occasion almost a decade ago at a hotel opening. Mm-hmm. The second Financial Times article puts Trump at the middle of a money laundering scheme in which his real estate deals were used to hide not just an infusion of capital from Russia and former Russian states, but to launder hundreds of millions looted by oligarchs. Well, that's an old trick, not just Russians. I mean, you know, oligarchs and dictators and kings have always done that. All Trump had to do was close his eyes to the source of the money, and suddenly empty apartments were going for top dollar. All right. Among the dozens of companies, the Almaty lawyers say that the Karpunov laundering network used were three called Soho 3310, Soho 3311, and Soho 3203. The classiest apartments in Soho, believe me. Each was a limited liability company, meaning their ownership could easily be concealed. That's how it works. I had an LLC once, and yeah, you can do that. Companies were created in much less successful than any of Trump's, I assure you. The Trump companies were created in 2013 in New York. A week later, property records show they paid a total of $3.1 million to buy the apartments that corresponded with their names in the Trump Soho, a 46-story luxury hotel condominium completed in 2010 in a chic corner of Manhattan. Why would Trump's organization make such a good means of laundering funds? Because real estate has an arbitrary value. And is that apartment worth $1 million? $2 million? Why not $3 million for a buyer who really wants it? when the whole transaction is just one LLC with an undisclosed ownership paying another LLC with undisclosed ownership, it's even neater than hiding the money in an offshore account. And while some businesses require due diligence in looking at the source of funds, real estate is a bit more, and he puts in italics the word, flexible. Well, we know that, don't we? Anybody seen The Big Short? The laws regarding U.S. real estate deals are scant, experts say. This is, again, Financial Times. Provisions against terrorism financing in the Patriot Act, passed in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, obliged mortgage lenders to conduct, quote, know your customer research. We needed, you know, the Patriot Act to make sure they did that. Otherwise, you know, who cares? But money launderers pay in cash. Sales such as those of the Trump Soho apartments have passed through this loophole, which was partially closed only this year. And expect that loophole to get thrown wide open again by this diligent Congress. You bet. You betcha, as Sarah Palin will or might say. Converting funds stolen overseas into property in the U.S. and cash in the account of an LLC represented a win for both the oligarchs and Trump. Not for us, though. Best of all, Trump's sole requirement was that he pay scant attention to the deal, something in which he was already a proven master. For example, the actual owners of the Trump Soho were another limited liability company, Bayrock. Trump was a partner in the LLC, and Bayrock cut the checks to Trump received when those apartments were sold. And yet, in a 2011 deposition given in a dispute over the Fort Lauderdale project, you know, their South Florida connection, Mr. Trump said he, quote, never really understood who owned Bayrock, conveniently. Jody Kriss, a former Bayrock finance director, has claimed in racketeering lawsuits against his former employer that Bayrock's backers included, quote, hidden interests in Russia and Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan, for glorious country of Kazakhstan. Bayrock has denied Mr. Kriss's allegations. Allegations, but declined to answer questions about the source of its fund and its relationship with the Krapunovs. Sorry for getting that name wrong. Krapunov is the name of these, of the very wholesome business interest. The third article digs more deeply into the origins of Bayrock and its connection with Trump. That connection was very close. The Republican presidential nominee and Bayrock were both based in Trump Tower, and they enjoyed forces to pursue deals around the world, from New York, Florida, Arizona, and Colorado in the U.S. to Turkey, Poland, Russia, and Ukraine. Their best-known collaboration, Trump Soho, a 46-story hotel condominium completed in 2010, was featured in Mr. Trump's NBC television show, The Apprentice. Everything you love about Trump, guys, Russian spy or mafia money, but who cares? Because America, bald eagle, war with Mexico. This is the same group about which Trump said he, quote, never really understood the ownership. I don't know who owns Bayrock, Mr. Trump said. I never really understood who owned Bayrock. I know they're a developer that's done quite a bit of work, but I don't know how they have their ownership broken down, says Don Sr. At the very least, Trump confessed to partnering with, taking money from, and acting as a representative for a corporation whose ownership he didn't know in deals that totaled hundreds of millions of dollars in countries around the world. Seems fine. However, it seems far more likely that Trump knowingly worked with oligarchs, groups associated with the Russian government, and plain old mobsters. Why? Because he was desperate. Back to Financial Times. In the 2000s, the property developer and casino owner with ready access to the capital markets and biggest New York banks was no more. A series of corporate bankruptcies had limited his financing options. Mr. Trump had become an entertainer who portrayed a tycoon on television and licensed his name to businesses looking for a brand, leading to fee-making opportunities as disparate as Trump University and Trump Vodka, the classiest vodka that no one ever drinks. The Trump organization was a hollow shell and Trump was bankrupt, but Donald Trump, the public figure, was, quote, a successful businessman, a screen behind which criminal activity could be carried out on a massive scale, claims Mark Sumner. Throwing his name at every scheme in existence wasn't a strategy. It was a fire sale on Trump's respectability. Steaks, water, vodka, fake real estate school? You pony up cash and Trump will slap his name on it. Because by the early 2000s, Trump wasn't just broke, he had nothing left to pawn. He wasn't a successful businessman, but he still played one on TV. Literally. His image had more value than his real estate portfolio. Literally. But the apartments and buildings where Trump held some degree of ownership could be turned into value again. All it took was partnering with foreign crime bosses looking for a place to stash their cash. Does anybody doubt any of this? I mean, I know my listeners probably don't. But not only does it seem extraordinarily plausible, it makes sense. To inflate the value of his portfolio, Trump had to do nothing other than look the other way as dirty money poured in from one LLC to the next. Citizens in Russia, Kazakhstan, and other former Soviet states lost hundreds of millions. Well, of course they did. But Trump got a cut as looted funds flowed through offices and apartments and buildings that carried those critical gold letters. So obviously you're asking, well, shouldn't Russians be angry? Well, no, because Putin's in on all this, of course. Horton's evaluation of this material in coordination with declassified DNI report is that Trump actively worked with and for Russian interests. What these exposés showed is that Trump pursued the projects hand in glove with Russian mobsters who worked closely with Putin's Kremlin. But based on the information in the Financial Times report, it appears that there are actually two possible answers. Trump may have been actively involved with and working for Russian sources. He might also have simply played a role as useful idiot, displaying his readiness to feign ignorance about any deal so long as it generated some funds to float his sinking boat. Is either one better for you? Do you feel better about either of those, Dad? In the end, there's not a lot of difference in the outcome. Trump got money. Oligarchs cleaned their cash. Russia got their man. And boy, did they ever. I mean, it must have been great for the Russians when Trump was just this real estate guy that they could launder money through his properties. Now he's effing president of the United States. I mean, I have to laugh because it's so horrifying and frightening that I don't know literally what else to do. I'm going to take a quick break here. When we get back, we're going to talk about the impending death of the ACA / Obamacare and what that means for you and for us and what we can do about it, if anything. Don't go anywhere. I will be right back. To Irreverent Testimony. In this last half, I'm going to read some more stories for you. And I'm also, I want to get to talking about ACA and what's happening and what will happen when it gets repealed. And it will be repealed. I'd be fairly shocked if it didn't. There have been a lot of think pieces the last 2 weeks because of some of the hedging by some members of Congress. That maybe it's not going to get repealed after all, or it won't get repealed for several years. It's going to get repealed pretty quick. So what does it mean? Well, what's happened so far? A lot of people are confused. A lot of people think that the procedural votes that took place in the Senate and House and passed were the full repealing of the ACA, aka Obamacare. They weren't. They were measures that paved the way so that it can basically a simple repeal vote can take place. So it sort of, you know, laid the groundwork for repeal, which is going to happen. Now, there have also been a lot of think pieces, again, in this era of journalists and commentators still thinking anything matters and anybody with an R next to their name cares about anything or anybody. That, well, how are they going to do this? It's going to be a big political mess. They're going to get stuck holding the bag if they kick 20 million people off health insurance without a viable replacement. And I'm thinking, what party do they think they've been watching for the past 20 years? Of course they'll kick 20 million people off their insurance and happily replace it with Jack Squat if they want to. But this is how I think, this is how it's going to go down, basically. They are going to repeal ACA. It's going to pass the Senate. It's going to pass the House. Dems will attempt to filibuster. They will attempt to gum up the works. It's not going to work. It'll maybe delay it for a little bit. And it's just not going to happen because because of gerrymandering and because of the makeup mostly of the House, you have people in Congress that even if their inboxes got flooded, and thank you, by the way, I think that some of our listeners did take heed to our advice to call and harass your representatives in your district about this stuff, a lot of this stuff, ACA included. And I've seen a lot of articles. Word on the street is that congressional staffers are just getting sick of all the people calling in complaining about all the crap Congress is doing, which is great because some of that is filtering through. How much of a difference is going to make? Well, it did stop them from gutting the Independent Ethics Oversight Committee. So that is something, and something to be proud of about. Excuse me. And now, of course, Jason Chaffetz is trying to go after the ethics watchdogs who were looking into Trump's Russia ties because, you know, he's such a bold, principled Republican from Utah, is Chaffetz. But anyway, what's going to happen with ACA? They're going to repeal it. They're going to throw something together that's far inferior. If they have their way, it won't even cover, you know, pre-existing conditions or any of the other very important tenets of ACA that people really, really like and need and want. They're going to offer a really, really crappy alternative that does not cover as many people, does not cover them as well, is way more expensive or much shittier, and or any combination or all of their above. Democrats are going to balk. And they're going to insist on something that's very, very close to, if not just a replication of ACA, which is sort of our one very dim hope. And I'll get to that in a minute. And then Republicans are going to gamble that they're going to turn it around and say, well, you see, it's the Democrats who are keeping you from getting health care because we offered this great, this wonderful alternative, and they're just voting no to score political points. I mean, that's exactly what they're going to say. There's no doubt in my mind. And they're going to take away your health care, and we're either going to get this very crappy replacement or no replacement at all that they're going to turn around and blame on Democrats and Obama and hope that that flies. That is, I don't see it ending any other way than that. Many of you out there, and I used ACA via a state exchange here in Colorado for about a year, and it was very good, and I was very happy with it. It was far from perfect. It was way, way better than being not covered. And that's going away. And we're going to lose that. And we're going to lose Medicaid expansion in a lot of these states, which in some states has just happened. And millions of people are going to lose their coverage. And across the board, healthcare is going to go up and become tougher to get for also millions of people. Because one thing ACA did was also drive down the rising coverage in private costs and even employer-sponsored costs. A lot of people don't realize this, of course. Because what happens when you don't have coverage? You get sick, you go to the ER. That just increases costs for everybody. So, look, I hope I'm wrong, but ACA is gone. It's a matter of time. And it's not going to be replaced by anything good or viable as long as there is a Republican president and a Republican Congress. That's the bottom line. Now, here's our one hope and our one chance. If, first of all, they're not going to delay or stop or roll back the idea of repealing ACA as it stands today. That's going to happen, or at least huge parts of it. So let's think about what we can do. If enough people, like these good, always Republican voting folks in Kentucky who are now just coming to realize that, wait a minute, Connect actually equals Obamacare and Mitch McConnell lied to us. And, you know, my grandfather with cancer, he can't lose his insurance. Oh no. If enough of them flood the staffers' phones and emails with complaints, then there's the slightest of chances that the Republicans may be inclined to do something like this. Repeal ACA, have a replacement plan that is basically ACA but called Trump Care or Ryan Care or whatever you want to call it. Just get that yucky Obamacare label off of it, and we'll call it something else, and it'll effectively be the same, but we'll say it's really, 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 really different. And get enough Democrats to go along with that and say, fine, and you can act like you've won. First of all, that's very, very difficult to do. It's not like what Republicans are trying to do and throw something together here in a week. ACA took years to develop, and so many moving pieces and so much went into it to make it work. It's not something you can throw together in a week and that will be effective. But let's pretend in some sort of fantasy world that is what somehow did or does happen, right? Now you have, again, I go back to the gerrymandering and the constituency. The hardcore Republican supporters of these people in Congress, they want ACA / Obamacare, and many of them don't know it's the same thing, but we'll get to that in a minute. They want it repealed, and I think a lot of these Republicans in Congress are much more afraid of being primaried by the right than losing in a general with a bunch of angry local constituents who now turn out actually did not want ACA repealed when they thought they did or said they did or didn't care before or whatever. There's also a risk that if they were to repeal and replace with something that is the same as ACA and only different in name only, that they would see right through that, and Fox and Rush Limbaugh would see right through that. And then I don't know. There's a lot of moving pieces. And I think what's going to happen, unfortunately, is that ACA will be repealed and either not be replaced at all for the reasons I mentioned before, or will be replaced with something very, very crappy and not anything close to what it was before. And I don't think Republicans care. I know they don't care. They've expressed as much. And certainly the think tank people on the right don't care, because they've expressed that healthcare is not a right. It is a privilege of those who can afford it, and if not, too bad, and just go die. So that's where we are. We're back to the let them die wing of the Republican Party, which is now in control. And ACA is going to be repealed. And the most we can hope for is that we raise enough of a stink, and Bernie Sanders and these other people are holding all these rallies. Rallies don't mean jack crap. It is calls and action, calls to your representatives and letting them know you are going to vote against them if they go this way. That's what it's going to take. And maybe, you know, Bernie Sanders and these folks can express this at these rallies and get people to do this. Of course, I get frustrated because I know that of these millions and millions of people that are hopefully going to call their elected representatives and say, either we don't want you to repeal ACA or we want you to replace it with ACA, that these folks had a chance to vote in the presidential election or in their congressional elections for people who did not want to repeal ACA. And they chose not to because Trump, bald eagle, America, make America great, to her emails, whatever. But hindsight is 2020, and it does us no good to relitigate that or wonder what the hell is wrong with these people. We just have to move forward and motivate as many of them as we can to now put pressure on their, and don't count on Trump, because I also see these people saying, well, wait a minute, Trump talked about not getting rid of the caps, not getting rid of the pre-existing condition stuff. So if they craft a bill that is, you know, takes that stuff away, maybe Trump won't sign it. No, Trump is going to sign it because Trump wants Obamacare to go away because it has the name Obama attached to it. And he will sign a crappy healthcare replacement bill that sucks and doesn't cover anybody. LOL that you think he won't. LOL that you think he cares. No. So if you're if you're actually counting on Donald Trump to save the day in terms of your health care, I have to laugh because the thought is so ridiculous. Don't. No. That's not going to happen. You need to call your elected representatives. And then again, the one and only very slim hope is that the Republicans repeal Obamacare and then replace it with Obamacare called Ryan Care or McConnell Care or Freedom America, Bald Eagle Healthcare, great, wonderful things, but not Obamacare. Like, they can literally call it that and it'll be the same thing and that'll be fine. And they'll just assume everybody's really, really stupid, which they do. That's our only hope. And I don't think it's likely, but that's literally, I think, our only hope. So that 20 million people don't completely lose their coverage and are left twisting in the wind, which is, I think, what is likely going to happen, because the Republicans just don't fucking care about you, and they don't care about me, and they don't care about anybody except themselves and their immediate family members and friends. And so that's where we're heading. Repeal and replace with something better sounds good politically, but what they really want is just for people not to have health care. That's the bottom line. They don't want people to have health care, and they're going to fight to make that a reality, and it's going to happen. And like I said, the only thing we can do about it is raise bloody hell, scream bloody murder, hope that we all survive without health care, many of us, till 2018, when we can make a difference legislatively, although we know how that goes in midterm, so I'm not overly hopeful or enthusiastic about that. But these are our options. I'm presenting you with what our realistic options are right now in the face of the fact that ACA is gone. It is a matter of time. It's gone. It's going away. Goodbye. Stop pretending otherwise. Let's deal with that reality and do what we can within the paradigm of the reality that ACA will not exist the way we know it for much longer. And so to that end, I want to read a little something where Americans are now waking up to this reality where they didn't for years for some reason. This is an article from something, an online publication called Quartz. I don't really know it, but this is what we got in this article called provocative name, I Will Die. Americans plead with Republicans politicians not to repeal Obamacare. So it reads, both sides of the U.S. Congress made the first steps towards repealing the Affordable Care Act this past week. Both sides, they mean the House and the Senate. Casting votes that set in motion the dismantling of outgoing President Barack Obama's landmark health care bill, although no one knows how or when it may be replaced. And no Republican actually cares either. No Republican politician, at least. As the Republican-led push to kill what's become known as Obamacare gains steam, though, Americans from both parties are pleading with politicians on social media, at town halls, remember those, and through press conferences and rallies, and hopefully by calling their congresspeople, not to tear it down without a replacement. It should say a viable replacement, because you can replace it with dog shit and say you replaced it, and then, you know, whatever. The repeal of the act is expected to leave some 20 million people, many of them self-employed or with pre-existing conditions whose insurance companies have traditionally refused to cover, completely uninsured. The repeal would also give the 400 richest households in America an average tax cut of $7 million each. Yay! Trickle down. Even with ACA, the U.S. remains the only major developed nation without universal health care. While the Health Care Act has been characterized as a Democratic folly by Republicans, people who have signed on say it has literally been a lifesaver and warn its repeal would be a national crisis. Tennessee residents flooded Senator Lamar Alexander's Nashville office in person. This is what I'm talking about, guys. Good job in Tennessee. Of course, you could have not voted this asshole in the first place, but forgetting that, good job. Tennessee residents flooded Senator Lamar Alexander's Nashville office in person this week to ask the Republican not to repeal the bill without a replacement. Quote, none of us walk into the hospital as a Republican or a Democrat, Kristen Grimm, whose son has had 19 surgeries because of a condition he was born with, told Alexander, the Spring Hill homepage reported. We all enter as human beings seeking mercy and quality health care. From Republicans? LOL. About 270,000 people in Tennessee are covered by the ACA. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee held a January 12 press conference with doctors, nurses, and some of the state's 750,000 people covered under the act to beg politicians in Washington, D.C. not to repeal the act without a replacement, local KOMO News reported. Christine Griffiths, a breast cancer survivor who relies on ACA, said if she was afraid it would be dismantled, said she would. Okay, this is how it's typed, but not well edited. If she was afraid it would be dismantled with no replacement, because I will have no other option than just to not treat myself and I will die. Yeah, that's what happens without health coverage. On January 12th, a self-described, quote, Republican who worked for Reagan and Bush campaigns, who also said he was against Obamacare when it first appeared, confronted House Speaker Paul Ryan, a chief proponent of repeal plans, during a CNN town hall. After getting cancer, he said Obamacare saved his life. Why would you repeal the Affordable Care Act without a replacement, he asks. I want to thank President Obama from the bottom of my heart, because I would be dead if it weren't for him. On Twitter, U.S. citizens shared stories of how Health Care Act had saved their lives under the Save ACA hashtag. And this one reads, may each one of these men experience the anxiety that I, as a cancer patient, feel right now, knowing I'll die if care becomes unavailable. And thousands have left comments about health care on the Facebook pages of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican who has declared repealing the Affordable Care Act a priority back in 2010. Most of them are sharply critical. Here's a real story for you. This is quoting the story. I have a pre-existing condition that requires battery replacement surgery about every 10 years. I have relied heavily on ACA for my regular cardiology appointments since 2010. I'm due for surgery sometime this summer/fall. My union insurance doesn't kick in until early 2018. Watch that go away too under Trump and the Republicans. Without ACA, I won't be able to afford surgery. Without surgery, my heart will stop. I've never felt such a direct attack from right-wing politicians before. Well, you haven't? They've been at this for years, buddy. Anyway, the Affordable Care Act was one of the most successful exchange programs in the nation and provided hundreds and thousands of people with affordable health care. It dropped the uninsured rate and gave some people health insurance for the first time ever in their lives. You are going to repeal people's health care without a replacement and ruin the lives of so many. You are a disgrace and embarrassment to Kentucky and the USA. Yet Kentuckians keep voting him in. Tomorrow, Save Healthcare rallies will be held across the U.S. from San Francisco to Portland, Maine. And this was printed, there's not a date on it, so I don't know when tomorrow is. Nice job there, guys. But I don't know if these rallies are today. I think some of them are. And like I said, rallies are great. I'm going to be attending one next week, a women's rally here in Denver. But rallies ultimately don't solve anything. They can organize people. They can get people fired up. So they serve that purpose in getting people fired up to then take the action they need to take. And that is to directly, like I love what they did in Tennessee with Lamar Alexander, directly confront your senator. And even if they don't show up personally to address you, then the press is there, media covers it, or to call the office and talk to staffers who, as we said, will pass these messages on. So that's great. People are making noise. Even Republicans who voted for this are now realizing, oh, wait a minute, they really are going to repeal my health care. Oh, that's bad. I don't want to die of the cancer. I better do something about it. So we are putting this pressure on, and it could maybe help in a roundabout way, not stopping them from repealing ACA, which is, I am completely convinced is going to happen, but maybe actually forcing them to replace it with something that's very, very close and just not calling it Obamacare so they can call it a win and say, yes, we repealed evil Obamacare and replaced it with American Bald Eagle Freedom Care. So maybe that can happen. I'm not hopeful, but that's our only shot. Anyway, I'm going to switch gears here for a minute. And our friend Sarah Burris, who obviously has been on the podcast a bunch of times, she will be back on again soon. We're giving her some room and space to take care of the things she needs to care for with her actual vocation, which is writing for Raw Story. And she writes, a bunch of stuff. I'm trying to pull up one of the articles here that I will get to in a moment. But now, of course, Raw Story has become slow and refuses to load the page. So let's go back to Daily Coast for a hot minute. There's coverage, of course, of the John Lewis stuff, which I covered, which is horribly embarrassing for Republicans and for Trump, but I don't think will amount to anything because nobody cares about anything anymore. But we do. And let's look at some of the headline articles there today and talk about what's going on there. Latino musicians and Russian hackers are basically the same thing, says House Republican, which Laura Clausen writes. I'm sure that's enraging and stupefying, but let's move past that. Here's something a little more interesting. Gallup finds Trump's transition performance approval far below his predecessors. So typically, even in a contested election, once the incoming president is coming in, he's got the benefit of the doubt for most people. That certainly happened with Obama in 2008. So let's see where we are. Let's look at Bill Clinton, his incoming approval, disapproval of the way he's handling his presidential transition. In January of 1993, just before he came into office, there was a 68% approval, 18% disapprove, 15% no opinion. Pretty strong. For George W. Bush, much, much more obviously hotly contested. We had hanging chads and the Supreme Court and everything else, and it was 50-50 at best, and Gore won the popular vote, obviously. Even with all that contentiousness, coming in January 15th, per Gallup, approval or disapproval of presidential transition, 61% approve, only 25% disapprove, 14% no opinion. A lot of Democrats fell in line and gave the benefit of the doubt and said, okay, he's the president now. You know, we didn't like what happened with the Supreme Court. We didn't like the hanging chad business. But whatever, Gore conceded, let's move on. Barack Obama, 2009. Barack Obama obviously won by a big margin. There was not much controversy. People kind of united behind him. January 9th through 11th, 83% approve, 12% disapprove, 5% no opinion. Now let's look at Trump. What are we looking at as of basically the last week or so, as far as Gallup goes, in the presidential transition? 44% approve, 51% disapprove, only 4% with no opinion. Wow, have we gotten divided here in this country, clearly. So that's interesting. What does it amount to? Well, when John Lewis says things like, I don't find this president necessarily to be legitimate, I think that is resonating with many, many more Americans than ever has before for an incoming president. So we go on to say, we go on to hear from Gallup. Looking at both positive and negative ratings, Americans view Trump's cabinet as worse than the cabinets chosen by Obama, Bush, and Clinton. I don't know if those numbers necessarily mean that, Gallup, but okay. However, taking into account just the percentage who consider his cabinet, quote, above average or outstanding, Trump's 32% is only modestly lower than 38% for Bush in January 2001 and matches Clinton before his inauguration before mid-January 1993. Only Obama's 45% was significantly better. The chief differentiator for Trump is that many more Americans rate his appointments as below average or poor. 44% say this about Trump's cabinet choices compared with 13% for Bush's, 12% for Clinton's, and 10% for Obama's. The widespread between positive and negative views of Trump's cabinet appointments serves as another example of the highly polarized environment in which Trump will be taking office on January 20th. And again, I say, yes, that's interesting. Yes, that's fine. But is it going to keep Republican Congress from rubber stamping basically all of them? I don't think so. There was a lot of talk about Rubio, who was given the business, at least in his questioning, to Tillerson in those hearings. Who effing cares? He's going to rubber stamp it. He's going to say, I have reservations, blah, blah, blah. He's going to approve him. It doesn't mean anything. It was a self-aggrandizing moment. And because the press is so infatuated with Marco Rubio, they ate it up, hook, line, and sinker. It's fucking meaningless. He's going to approve Tillerson, who's an awful, awful, awful choice for a myriad reasons that many other people have gotten into. So now, do we finally have the Cerebrus story archive pulled up? We do. And back to Trump and Russia then with a recent story that she had here. Russia, I didn't see anything about Russia. The internet mocks Trump's lunk-headed post-briefing statement. I have to ask Sarah if she wrote the headline, the word lunk-headed, in her headline. I have a feeling that maybe not. Anyway, the story reads, President-elect Donald Trump finally had his intelligence briefing that outlined the evidence that Russia hacked the United States election and fed information to WikiLeaks. Ugh, WikiLeaks, dude. For weeks, Trump has denied that this evidence could be true, saying at one point that he, quote, knows things others don't know about the Russia hacking. I mean, he knows a lot about Russia that others don't know. So, quote, so they cannot be sure of the situation, Trump said outside Mar-a-Lago on New Year's Eve. Quote, these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, Trump's transition team said in another statement following a Washington Post report. So while that's sort of a fair point, I guess, is like the insinuation now that you're just not going to listen to intelligence briefings? You're just going to ignore the intelligence apparatus? Just make up your own mind? Okay. Cool. Cool story, bro. Friday after his briefing, Trump suddenly changed his approach and language, claiming that there's no proof that Russia hacked voting machines or that it made any difference. Like that was ever the topic, right? This dramatic shift was noticed by Twitter and mocked soundly. Brian Bameen says, I think my favorite joke out of this whole Russia hacking debacle is asking Trump how Putin's dick tastes. That's succinct. Evan McMullen said, even after his briefing, Trump continues to actively obscure Russia's multifaceted ongoing attack on American democracy on his behalf. Sarah Burris, who wrote the story, also tweets, Trump conveniently forgets to admit that he was wrong after intel briefing. Watch for him to suddenly stop talking about Russia entirely. Well, she was wrong. He's still talking about Russia, just in wonderfully glowing terms. Don the Con, at Loser-in-Chief, says, I think it's time that Donald Trump showed America how much debt he has in Russia. Americans have the right to know. Sure. Why would he do that? Who's going to make him do that? Top conservative cat at Tea Party Cat says, Trump, Russia did hack the DNC, but only to get me elected, so that's fine. I only wish they hacked in 2008 so we didn't have Obama now. I don't know if Trump actually said that verbatim, but why not? LOL GOP says he told us it was rigged. Yeah. Sarah, again, Trump, shorter, Russia, question mark? I didn't say anything about Russia. Right. John Ralston of Ralston Reports in Nevada. Shorter Trump, lip service to pros, Russia and others always be hacking. I won fair and square, RNC equals better than DNC. Experts I derided will give me plan. LOL GOP says, weird. The guy who was sure a black president had to be born in Kenya refuses to believe that a white president tried to help him. Gail Alstrom, believe Russia wanted Trump to be president because easier to deal with an idiot than a smart person. That's part of it, but Gail, we're learning it goes much, 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 much deeper than that. Susan Hennessy says, his message should be, quote, if Putin thought he was getting a friend, he's the idiot. Well, but he is getting a friend, so why would he relay that message? Plus, he is in hock to Putin and the Russian mob, and they have blackmail piss videos on him. So in what universe is he going to say that? And then she says, maybe Russia didn't change election outcome, but anything Trump does now that rewards Russia directly undermines our national security. Susan, Russia did help change the election outcome. And anything Trump does now rewards Russia directly, undermines our national security, and that's all he's going to do. Jesse Natale says, it takes a real man to admit that he was wrong, which is why we will never hear Trump admit that Russia had an impact on our election. It's not, Jess, it's not about right and wrong. And it's not about what Trump does or doesn't know. Trump knows exactly what Russia is doing and has done, and helped not only prop him up to the president, but propped him up to make him a quote successful businessman and real estate owner again. Sir Alan Hatman says, butthurt Donald Trump still butthurt about Russia maybe stealing election for him. No, he knows they did. He just hates that people know it. Sarah again says, American trolls are furious Trump outsourced paid trolls to Russia. Jerry Ford Jr. says, so instead of investigating Russia, Trump wants to investigate his own intelligence community. Well, he's going to gut his own intelligence community and replace them with sycophants. And Russophiles. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. Trump said at a room full of TV cameras, as well as reporters from the Miami Herald, Tampa Times. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. Nobody cares. He said it. No one cared. They elected him president. At Broderick Topil says, remember when Trump invited Russia to tamper with the election? Yes, I do. Catherine Harris, not that Catherine Harris, the one from Florida circa 2000, says, truly curious as to how Trump supporters will talk their way out of this new report on Russia trolling them. They don't care, Catherine. They don't care. Dale Seaver says, wait, when Trump was calling on Russia to hack Hillary's emails, did he think he was talking to a 14-year-old in a bedroom? Okay. Diane says, Trump can't accept IC assessment that Russia influenced the election because it portrays him as a weaker candidate Putin could control. Well, yes, and he is that, and no, he won't admit it. So there's that. So again, I'll reiterate, where all this is going is we've known about these Trump-Russia ties long before. Well, I mean, we knew it before the GOP primary was decided. The media just really wasn't interested in covering it very much. It was all about Hillary's emails, and still was right up through Election Day. So, and again, you have to understand this. And people are in denial and don't refuse to acknowledge it. Once Trump takes the oath of office and he is the president of the United States, he's going to gut the Department of Justice. He's going to gut the intelligence agencies. He's going to gut the oversight in any meaningful way that would investigate and bring these links to light and do something about it. And the Republican Congress is not going to stand in his way. A few members might, but ultimately the heavy hitters, the Mitch McConnells and the Paul Ryans and the Marco Rubios, are these people going to step in and really demand and enable very strong, meaningful investigations of Trump ties with the Kremlin and with the Russian mob? The answer is no, because Trump is going to install a series of sycophants and Russophiles and Kremlin puppets, and this is real life, and this is really happening. And none of the proud, flag-wrapped, bald eagle America, apple pie-loving Republican American congressmen are going to do anything to stop it. I guarantee this is how this is going to play out. And if I was here with Rachel now, I could argue with her. As this materializes in front of our eyes, will people like her father and these Trump supporters, these Trump rally people, will they care? And the answer is no, because they're going to be in denial about this. They cannot admit to themselves this is actually happening. And as it becomes clear that American policy going forward is that to benefit Russia more than the American people, they will either continue to deny it, or they will blame Democrats somehow, or they will just plug their fingers in their ear and they will not face this reality. period. So that 35% core of Trump can do no wrong people, they're not going to turn on him for anything. They're just not. And no, he's not going to be able to build the wall. And no, he's not going to be able to deport 9 million people. And no, he's not going to bring all the manufacturing jobs back that have disappeared due to automation. And no, he's not going to be able to do any of these things. And none of these people are going to care because they did not elect him because he thought he would actually do this stuff. They elected him because it felt good, because he raised these middle fingers to the establishment and to the new world of political correctness and racial and sexual tolerance that has been enveloped and taken over and changed the face of this country in ways they don't like. It was about going to the ballot box and raising a middle finger to a changing world that eats into white, cis, straight hegemony, period. That is what this is about. This is about hearing too much non-English, seeing too many gay people being out in the open rather than behind closed doors, and too much political correctness in their mind run amok. That's what this is about. This is not about a mythical idea of bringing jobs back that are never coming back, or building a wall with Mexico that's never going to happen, or repealing Obamacare and replacing it with magical socialist medical care that's not socialist and is called Freedom Bald Eagle Care. It's not about that. It never was. And if the price to pay for having that feeling when they could go into the ballot box on election day and pull that lever for the guy that's raising his middle finger at Black Lives Matter and gay marriage advocates and feminists and everybody else they despise and that scares them, if the price for that is being puppet, is for the President of the United States and the United States Congress and the intelligence apparatus to be a puppet of the Kremlin, they're willing to trade off for that or pretend it doesn't exist. That is the reality we're facing. That is the new world we are facing. And if you're expecting the Republican-controlled Congress to stand up to it, it's not going to happen. The people to stand up to it are us. It's us. We have to take to the streets. We have to storm the offices of our local elected officials and our congresspeople. And we have to try to somehow affect change. And eventually, we have to organize and actually find candidates to get these people voted out somehow. And that's a much tougher climb for a variety of reasons. So that's it. That's my rant for this January 14th, 2017. Just a mere few days away from swearing in this person to the highest elected office and the most powerful elected office in the world. God help us. God save us. We're on the clock now, because the people who have been elected to represent the best interests of the people of this country are not going to do that. So it's up to us. So it's our time now. We do it, or our republic shall perish. And that's not hyperbole. So have a great weekend, everybody, and enjoy the football games, and enjoy your time with your family. Enjoy your day off on Monday. Martin Luther King holiday, which the city of Biloxi, Mississippi, had the nerve to come out on Twitter and declare as Great American Day or something, like purposely let it be known they're not going to call it MLK Day. But, that's Mississippi. So that'll do it for me. We'll be back next week. Rachel and I, at least, we're going to try to get my friend Sandy, who's a lawyer representing protesters at Standing Rock, to come on, and can't wait for that. And more stuff coming up. Stay active, stay tuned, stay involved. Hate mail, irreverenttestimony@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter @irreverentduo. And that's it. Take care, and talk to you again soon. Bye.